On This Week at Enterprise Tech, Intel's got maybe affordable Crosspoint product for you. Florida gets a robotic truck. The FBI wants an encryption unicorn. And Mo Williams drops by to tell you to not panic and Wi-Fi on. It's Wyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 281, recorded March 9th, 2018. Wi-Fi changes to WPA3. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. And by IT Pro TV. Binge-worthy learning for IT pros. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Welcome to Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I'm going to need a little help. And what better help is there than my friends? Starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chivert, how go things for the geek in paradise?
Hey, man, I'm having a great time staring at my toilet seat on the back of my MacBook.
Okay. For those who don't follow our Twitter exchanges, you bought it. It was a newer LED ring light, correct?
Yeah. And it's dimmable, so it's pretty nice.
It actually looks pretty good. It's decent. And it was, what, like $100, and the web camera goes right in between it?
Yeah, yeah. It's actually got an adapter. I can even put an iPhone or something in there. So it's kind of cool.
And it's about this big, so people could walk around just getting good light on everything they're recording.
Yeah, and the shot that I posted to Twitter, it makes it look like there's a toilet seat bonded to the back of my MacBook.
It really does, kind of. So I'll just say happy flushing. Now, Curtis Franklin, you are in a new space. There's the toilet bowl. Doing your thing. My friend, are you settled in yet?
Well, we are settled into temporary digs. We are leasing a place short term while we look for a permanent location for what will be the Florida studios down here. So should be seeing this particular backdrop for, you know, a few weeks, and then the adventure continues apace.
Oh, fantastic. Well, the cast is set, and we've got one heck of an episode. We're going to be bringing back one of the friends from the interop days. We call her Mo, who's going to be telling you what's coming up in security in the wireless world. But as we always do, we got to kick it off with the blips. Now, yesterday, semiconductor giant Intel launched a new line of Crosspoint-enabled Optane-branded products, and it's interesting for what it isn't. Namely, unlike the previous Optane releases, which were pitched for accelerated hybrid storage caching or bragging rights enthusiasts with really deep pockets, it isn't aimed at a niche or super performance, super cost use case, but a more pedestrian market looking for a fast boot drive. The Intel Optane 800P is 58 or 118 gigabytes of cross-point memory on an M.2 2280 card that is rated for 1.4 gigabytes per second read and 600 megabytes per second write over PCIe 3.0x2. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, with PCIe-connected SSDs from Samsung and Kingston hitting 3 gigabytes per second in four-lane configurations. But the 800P tries to make up for its bandwidth deficiencies with very, very, very low latency and unmatched performance in 4K transfers at low Q depth. What does that mean in English? Well, most products touting incredible bandwidth numbers can do that at high Q depth with high latency. Intel's Optane products using cross-point memory modules provide their rated bandwidth at low Q depths. The end result is that while the bandwidth of enterprise-class NAND products will fall off under load and as the product ages, the Optane products maintain performance through load and through aging. The rest of it, 1.6 million hours mean time between failure, 5 years of guaranteed performance at up to 200 gigabytes of writes every day, a power draw of 3.75 watts in active mode, 8 milliwatts in sleep, and a price of, you probably can't afford it, but we'll find out soon enough, dollars.
Well, there's a new imperial era coming for Japan. And I didn't think I was going to see it in my lifetime, but as Japanese Emperor Akihito ascends to the throne, then Crown Prince Naruhito will ascend just afterward as his father abdicates. Why is this an enterprise story? Well, it's because the imperial line is super important in Japan, and I'm predicting a party to end all parties, with the general population and, of course, the tech industry being very distracted for a couple of weeks before and after the series of ceremonies. So if you do business with Japan, keep an eye on the events leading up to this and be sensitive to the Japanese people.
Intel's SGX can hide malware. Attackers can use Intel's Software Guard Extensions, SGX, microprocessor security feature to steal cryptographic keys and other secrets. That's the conclusion reached by researchers from the Graz University of Technology in Austria, and they plan to demonstrate how it happens at Black Hat Europe later this month. The researchers will present proof-of-concept malware that takes advantage of SGX's code protection features to hide from state-of-the-art detection tools. The main takeaway? Is that SGX can help attackers hide and execute malware without requiring any root privileges or operating system modifications, according to one of the researchers. Now, it's important to note that this malware does not exploit any vulnerability in SGX. Rather, it takes advantage of the fact that Intel considers software-based side-channel attacks on SGX as impossible and therefore out of scope. Now, what does history tell us about things that manufacturers don't consider possible?
I need your clothes, your boots, and your robotic truck. Now, the battle for enterprise-level logistics is heating up, and it might be a case of David versus Goliath versus Goliath versus David versus David. While several giants of the trucking manufacturing business, like Daimler and Volvo, have announced their own autonomous vehicle programs, much of the attention has been paid to Tesla with their spaceship-looking trucks and Uber, which announced this past Tuesday that they're starting a commercial delivery service in Arizona that includes a 344-mile route that will be navigated by their autonomous vehicle AI. Arizona, with its relatively simple vehicle safety regulations that are more than met by keeping a safety operator behind the wheel in case of a malfunction, is a natural choice for many of these startups to become giants to test their tech. But one new startup on the other side of the country is hoping to one-up the other players by deploying completely driverless delivery routes by the end of 2018. Starsky Robotics has decided to skip the man-in-the-middle stage altogether by combining driverless tech with a driver-hop-on-hop-off system. In a nutshell, Starsky trucks will handle highway driving entirely on their own, turning over control to a human driver for surface street navigation. Now, that in itself isn't new. It's a proposal that's been around since the start of autonomous truck development. But what is new is the fact that Starsky AI will turn over the vehicle to a wirelessly linked remote human pilot who uses a video game-like controller to guide trucks the last few miles to their destinations. The concept has promise and buzz. Starsky announced a $16.5 million Series A funding round, and they've already sent their trucks driverless down the roads in Florida. In other words, if you've ever wanted to be a truck driver, time to brush up on your Xbox or PlayStation skills.
2S or not 2S is now a free question for now. Currently, Windows 10 S is a unique edition of Windows 10. It's based on Windows 10 Pro. Windows 10 Pro has various facilities that enable system administrators to restrict which software can be run, and Windows 10 S is essentially a pre-configured version of those facilities. In addition to locking out arbitrary downloaded programs, it also prevents the use of certain built-in Windows features such as command line, PowerShell, and Windows subsystem for Linux. The catch is, once you turn on S mode, you can't go back without a reinstall. So flipping your kid's S mode lockdown machine into Pro mode to install special drivers means you can't go back. I'm maintaining that S-mode does make sense for schools and sensitive applications, but S-mode needs to have some administrator overrides in order to succeed, or Microsoft is going to need a whole lot of buy-in from S-mode developers.
Olympic Destroyer's false flag changes the malware game. This week, researchers from Kaspersky Lab revealed new details on how a sophisticated attack group behind the cyber attacks against the recent 2018 Winter Olympic network posed as an infamous North Korean nation-state group to throw off investigators. Olympic Destroyer temporarily disabled the Olympics' IT systems, shutting down Wi-Fi, monitors, and the Olympics' website so that ticket holders weren't able to print their tickets. Olympic Destroyer employed the Proton email service, the NordVPN service, as well as hosting provider MonoVM, all services that had been used by other hacking groups. So how did Kaspersky catch the real perpetrators? It turns out that the attackers may have inadvertently forgotten to encrypt some of the code, leaving it exposed as fake. The attacks initially appear to have all the earmarks of Lazarus Group. They wanted it to be discovered as Lazarus Group, said one of the researchers, saying that ego can overcome common sense, even among the hacking elite.
Now, for more than 2 weeks, reports have been floating about that a turnkey solution for unlocking iPhones existed in the wild. While rumors of unlocking services have been circulating since the FBI seemingly was able to contract a third party to unlock an iPhone in March of 2016, a commoditized service has been mostly speculation until now. Grayshift, a small American startup created by a former Apple security engineer and staffed by U.S. intelligence agency contractors, has been sending out marketing materials for their tool named Gray Key. Grayshift claims that their tool is able to unlock iPhones running iOS 11 and 10 with support for 9 upcoming. According to reports by Forbes, researchers have been able to see the tool work on the latest iPhone 8 and 10 models. In their marketing materials, Grayshift explains the capabilities as a brute force attack that allows the user to extract the full file system contents from the phone. If that's the case, then it's likely that Grayshift is using a weakness in the secure enclave processor, which should make brute force attempts progressively slower and therefore impossible. That's the same speculated exploit that Cellbrite, another company that is offering unlock services, is using in their product. The difference? While Cellbrite requires law enforcement to send devices to its labs, Grayshift is selling their tool to end users. $15,000 for a tool that will unlock 300 phones, or $30,000 for a tool with unlimited unlocks. Bottom line, there is no magic bullet for your data privacy. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're going into the bytes, and yeah, we are going to have to dive a bit more into encryption and security because it's back in the news thanks to the FBI. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you something. If you've ever gone in for a mortgage for your house or gone in to take out a loan, have you enjoyed the experience? Do you like getting grilled? Do you like being looked down upon by bank employees who are going to decide your fate, who are going to look at your pay stubs and your receipts and decide if you're worthy to receive a loan from their fine financial institution? Well, if you did enjoy that, then listen no further, because you're not going to be interested in the fact that there's a company out there that's looking to make the mortgage process that much simpler, that much easier. Of course, I'm talking about Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, Rocket Mortgage understood that the mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the digital age. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No more bringing in boxes of receipts and old, faded pay stubs. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And then with those calculations, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com /enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back into it. We've got a bite here, and it's kind of a doozy because it seems to be coming back again and again and again. And of course, we're talking about the FBI and your privacy through encryption. Now, the FBI seems to think that they can just wish for a magical solution for them to get into your encrypted data, and somehow it will only be used by the good guys. Well, that's not really the case. And yet, they made that case again at Boston College this past Wednesday. FBI Director Christopher Wray once again referred to the, quote, going dark, unquote, problem that has become a nightmare in law enforcement. Basically, with the proliferation of strong, easy-to-use encryption solutions that don't require any tech savvy, the FBI is saying that their job has become almost impossible. The iPhone lock from 2 years ago is just one example of this. They've got thousands of phones, thousands of devices, and just gigabytes and terabytes of encrypted communications that they'd love to have a gander at, but they claim that they just can't do it. They don't have the technical prowess to brute force that kind of encryption, and therefore they want some solution. They keep calling it some solution. And of course, we know that by some solution, what they really mean is encryption backdoor. Wray is advocating for a key escrow system, which would allow the FBI or any other authorized agency to bypass device encryption, given, quote, a certain set of circumstances. Now, there was a lot of parsing going on with this because he said certain set of circumstances rather than a warrant. Most of the time when they've been demanding this, they've been saying when there is a warrant issued for information on an individual or an organization, we should be able to decrypt that information so we can look for evidence of a crime. In this particular case, he specifically never mentioned warrant. He always used that term, certain set of circumstances, which has led some privacy experts to say he's expanding this. He's still asking for the encryption backdoor that the FBI has been asking for more than a year now. He's still saying that they're in this going dark problem. But now he's kind of saying, well, even if we don't have a warrant, if there's a certain set of circumstances, an exigent threat, then we should be able to just take a look at pretty much everything. We're definitely going to bring that up in the discussion. Now, this is not a new plea. We all know that the FBI has been strongly pushing for backdoors for at least 2 years. We've covered it here on This Week in Enterprise Tech. And they've been claiming that it's not impossible, even though every crypto expert has said the very fact that you put a backdoor into encryption means you are fundamentally breaking that encryption. Oh, by the way, Wray, referring to that exact oft-claimed backdoor would break encryption threat, has said, quote, I just don't buy the claim that it's impossible, unquote. Chiebert, let me throw this over to you first. Both of us have worked for the U.S. government at one point or another, doing different things. Both of us respect the job that law enforcement does. Both of us understand that it's very difficult, and yes, they are trying to do something that does keep us safe. Do you buy this? Do you buy the whole, well, when there is a set of circumstances, and then and only then will only the good guys look into your devices and your communications?
No, I do not, not even close. I've seen all kinds of misuses, and the sad fact is we're human. Humans have I've seen good people do bad things for the right reason. I've seen bad people do good things, you know, whatever you want. The reality is if there is a way to backdoor an encryption system, someone is going to misuse it. I just don't trust human nature. Having said that, yeah, I am ex-law enforcement, kind of, in a weird way. And I would love to support this, but I want it proven. I mean proven by, say, opening it to at DEF CON. Hey, how's that for a concept? Opening it at DEF CON to a hackathon, and I would say it would have to survive multiple years before I would even consider trusting this. I think our FBI director is smoking something really good because I think he's wishing someone had a magic wand and do Levosa, whatever's, you know, Hermione did, you know, wave that magic wand, make it happen magically, because I think that's the only way it's going to happen in the foreseeable future.
Right, right. Now, and the interesting thing about this whole debate is there's a certain faction of our society that is claiming that if you do not want an encryption backdoor, if you do not want to support the FBI, if you do not want to support law enforcement by making it easier for them to sift through digital communications, then somehow that means you're an anarchist, or somehow that means that you're not for the rule of law. That's simply not the case. Curtis, could you chime in on this? Because it does seem sometimes that that's the argument. It's if you do not want to support your law enforcement by giving them this authority and this tool, it means that you are trying to protect the bad guys.
Well, I had an interesting conversation just this week on this very, very topic. I was researching an article that will run next week over on Dark Reading, and I had a chance to talk with Michael Chertoff, the first Secretary of Homeland Security. And I specifically asked him about issues around encryption, and he was very clear that he does not think that there need to be any limits on the strength of encryption that can be used. He doesn't think there need to be any backdoors into encryption because that inherently weakens the encryption. This is someone who I think we can say has thought about security issues at the very highest level, and he sees that the benefit of having truly strong, highly resistant encryption available to individuals and corporations outweighs the potential good to law enforcement that could come to having weaker or broken encryption. To me, that was a critical moment when I got him on record talking about that. Do I wish that we could come up with an algorithmically sound way to allow some type of access after appropriate judicial review? Well, sure I do, and I've been at this too long to use the word impossible lightly, but I have yet to see such an algorithmic approach that would do that. And frankly, I would be absolutely stunned if one were developed within the next decade or so.
Yeah. And I think both you and Chibert have really nailed the major issues here. And let's start with the human concept here that Chibert brought up. I can imagine that not too long ago, there was this exact sort of discussion when they were setting up the FISA courts. And the whole idea is, well, this is only going to be used when it absolutely is necessary. It's only going to be used when we really, really need it. And now the abuse of that system has been well documented. It's the same thing with this idea of having a secure key enclave, this where all of the secrets are held and they'll only be used when they're absolutely necessary, makes sense as long as there are no humans in the loop. Because the minute that there are humans in the loop, you're going to have bias. You're going to have people who are acting out of their personal feelings or out of a political motivation, and that doesn't work. More than that, Chibert, and I want to throw this back over to you, it is possible to have a backdoor, and it is possible to have a backdoor that's secure, but the only way that works is if you make sure that key never, ever leaks. And we already have a very good example of a federal agency allowing that to happen. That's the TSA that made the master keys, the special keys that unlock TSA-approved locks. And someone had the bright idea to take a picture of it and put it into an article. Well, now anyone who has that picture can print themselves out a set of keys that unlock the luggage at airports. This is the same sort of thing. You have to assume it's going to leak. And if that leaks, it means you've basically just broken encryption for everybody. I mean, is there a feasible way to have a key and not have it leak and only be used exactly when it's supposed to be used?
No, not really. Now, I will go back and hit the Wayback Machine back about 35 years now. I was privy to a coffee room conversation about this brand new thing called SSL. And I was actually at the headquarters for the U.S. Postal Service. And I was saying, you know, why don't you guys, as the Postal Service, start going electronic? why don't you be the key authority? And if you make it inexpensive enough, then suddenly, you know, all these, you know, little people making this thing called a key authority might not survive, and you guys would be the key authority, at least for America. You know, that conversation got a lot of people going, but it was, nah, it'll never work. It's not enough business. Postal Service could never do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Curtis, I want to bring something else up here, and that is we often talk about the law of unintended consequences, and that's the fact that when you make a law, it could be completely out of good intentions. It could have a defined purpose, and yet somehow it will always have unintended consequences, and most of the time those unintended consequences are horrible. Really good example. There's a law in China right now that was passed that if you strike a pedestrian, if you strike somebody, you are responsible for their care for the rest of their lives. That's just how it works. It makes sense. If you maim someone, if you disable someone, you are now responsible for them. However, it led to a rash of people striking pedestrians and then backing up and hitting them again to make sure that they killed them. Because if you kill them, you pay out a huge sum once, not for the rest of your life. Law of intended, unintended consequences. When we look at that sort of law of unintended consequences here, when we are looking at something like how well the Clipper chip had worked or the previous attempts to enforce some sort of security backdoor, I'm really wondering about the international ramifications. And this is not just for security. This is for several different issues that have really been looking at what kind of pressure a U.S. agency can put on an international multinational company. If you have a U.S. law enforcement agency saying you must, if you want to sell products in this country, include some sort of backdoor that we have access to, doesn't that also set the precedent for every other country and every other law enforcement agency, every other intelligence service saying, well, you need to do the same thing here. You want to sell phones in Russia? We need a key. You want to sell phones in China? We need a key. You want to sell phones in Iran? We need a key. Isn't this just sort of saying, okay, nothing is secure?
Oh, it is. It is. And I think that's an important note. And I also think that weakening the encryption in this way could do something really fun, like run headlong into European privacy laws, the GDPR that we've talked about here on Twyatt. As Brian says, if humans were never involved, it might be easier, although we've seen many times where human bias is programmed into machine learning and artificial intelligence as well. I think that for the kind of unintended consequences we've talked about, we really have to look no further than in the U.S., the resource officer program in our public schools. You know, after 9/11, when we were, with great justification, quite worried about terrorist activity, huge sums of money were given to communities to put resource officers, typically police officers or sheriff's deputies, into public schools. I've known many of these resource officers, fine people, but if you look the case in Florida down at Stoneman Douglas High School shows that they've been very little use against mass shootings and terrorist activities. But what we have seen is a huge jump in the number of what used to be considered childish fist fights or wrestling matches that suddenly became felonies because a police officer was involved. The consequences of that decision have been entirely different than what were intended. And I think it's highly likely that the same would be true if we started walking down this particular unencryption path.
Indeed. Gilbert, I want to give you the last word on this because you had some particularly strong emotions around when we'll stop hearing about this.
Yeah. You know, one, we're not going to stop hearing about it until quantum computing actually becomes real. You know, it's a big enough issue that Mo doesn't really want to talk about it because it's going down a rabbit hole, and it's a very deep rabbit hole. But quantum computing has the potential, we don't know for sure, but it has the potential of actually making all encryption worthless. right. or very much. You know, that could stop this conversation dead in its tracks very quickly.
Of course, then you just have the FBI saying, now we're in a really dark, 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 dark zone. Go figure. Well, folks, we'll be coming back to this. I guarantee it, because it just keeps rearing its ugly head. But it's time to move on to my favorite part of the show. And that's when we invite a guest from outside to come in and drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. We're going to be talking to Heather Williams. We call her Mo. Chiebert and I know her from our interop days. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and take another moment to thank a sponsor of this week in enterprise tech. Now, Chiebert and I and Curtis and Lou, we get asked quite a bit by people we meet when we go out to events like CES or our favorite networking conference. How do I get into this? I mean, for us, it was pretty simple. It was just something that we fell into. We were the start of this IT generation. And you learned by doing. You learned by hanging around other people who knew how to do. You interned yourself so you could gather knowledge to the point at which you felt confident. Well, that's kind of changed. IT moves really, really fast now, and there is no old-style apprentice system, at least not an organized one. So the question is, how do you get into IT? How do you gather the knowledge you need to turn it into a career? And if you're already in IT, how do you make sure that your skills stay fresh? Well, there's only one answer for the Twilight Riot, and that's IT Pro TV. Now, IT Pro TV helps you to build or expand your IT career with content that's tailored just for you. IT Pro TV offers over 3,300 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training with more than 125 hours added each week. You can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on-demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or by using their iOS or Android apps. There's no need to go off-site for training. The training comes to you. Now, seasoned IT pros understand the importance of continuing education for career development. IT Pro TV does IT Live every day so that you know you're getting the most current IT training. Their current courses include things like Certified Ethical Hacker, Kali Linux, AWS, ITIL, and ISC Squared Security. If you're interested in IT Pro TV's team solutions, you can contact them for group pricing. It's a great way to make sure that your team stays up to date with the skills they need to do their jobs most efficiently. You can track your team's results and prove the ROI of your training spend with IT Pro TV's Supervisor Portal. You can gain full control of your team's training schedule so that you can create custom groups and training assignments. You can even see individual and group analytics, including logins, viewing time, video downloads, and course completion tracking. Whether you're eager to start your new career in IT, you're a seasoned IT pro looking for a refresher, or just looking for an engaging way to keep your team up to date, IT Pro TV offers effective and entertaining IT training. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise to learn more about IT Pro TV's team solutions and to request a free team trial. Or sign up for an individual monthly membership with a free 7-day trial at itpro.tv/enterprise. That's itpro.tv/enterprise. Code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Transcender practice exams and virtual labs, are normally $857 a year, but you only pay $600 when you go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30. Flexible trading, binge-worthy content, ROI proven. Join the more than 90,000 IT Pro TV members today, and we thank IT Pro TV for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Let's go ahead and welcome to the show Heather Mo Williams. Mo, good to see you, or good to hear from you.
Hi there. How are you guys?
You're coming to us over an audio-only link because you're doing something wonderful in a place without great bandwidth, and we thank you for joining us so that you can help us update our Wi-Fi knowledge. Now, Chiebert and I both know you from Interop. We both know you because you work with Ruckus, and you are one of our favorite Wi-Fi experts. So thanks for spending your time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we want to talk a little bit about encryption. Of course, this leads back to the byte and one of the blips that we had at the top of the show. Specifically, Wi-Fi encryption. WPA2 has sort of become the standard. It's what everybody uses. It's what everyone has on their devices. It's compatible with everything now. But it's a little old in the teeth. It's coming up on 15 years. Is it time for WPA2 to get a remake?
Yeah, I think definitely. When you consider the fact that the iPhone, the first version of the iPhone was still not even in the stores yet, and that cutting-edge technology was a BlackBerry when WPA2 came into being. I'd say that it's well past its time.
Right, right. And in our chat room, we've got JJ to the 484 saying, is there anything new since WPA2 got broken? And I think he's probably referring to the October of last year announcement at Black Hat, where it's, yeah. Tell us about that.
I don't want to slap anyone down, but I really bristle at the word broken. I would say that some egos got bruised at WPA2 and Wi-Fi in general were certainly not broken. I would agree that the world lost its ever-loving mind last October. So with the advent of crack, and certainly a lot of people when WPA3 was announced earlier this year and the enhancements to WPA2 were announced at the same time, a lot of fingers were pointed at the crack vulnerabilities. And as I pointed out, it's really well past time for moving along. If you consider the fact that in that same time period, take security out and just look at what we've done with Wi-Fi, we have gone from G to a couple of flavors of N, AC, 11AC, Wave 1 and 2, and now we're staring down the barrel of 11AX. And Wi-Fi doesn't stand still. It's always evolving, and the security that supports it needs to also.
Right. You know, it's interesting because there is a subset of our community who kind of lump together WPA2 with WEP. They're like, oh, they're both deprecated. They're both cracked. They're both broken. That's not really the case. Thank you for bringing up the fact that there's a lot of FUD surrounding this, but can you break it down? What were the vulnerabilities, the main vulnerabilities that they were able to discover with WPA2, and what are these enhancements that you're talking about?
Right. So and actually the enhancements, only a piece of the WPA2 enhancement talks to the mitigating the crack vulnerabilities. Right. So again, the crack vulnerabilities, there were about 10 CVEs that were identified. And for the most part, they had to do with unexpected client behavior, and in some cases on the AP side too. And it had to do with the four-way handshake. So being able to reuse a key and reset the counter on that. And so that could possibly lead to some injections and maybe even not decryption, but being able to see some of the data that was being transferred. It's really more badge worthy, in my opinion. And let me be clear, I'm a Wi-Fi engineer. And an InfoSec junkie. So I certainly wouldn't pass myself off as an InfoSec expert. But from the cracking and the hacking point of view, it's not that low-hanging fruit where you're going to get massive rewards like you would from an effective spear fishing or whaling technique. With crack, I would say that there's going to be someone out there that's going to maybe one day actually in the wild effectively complete a crack attack, and they're not going to get anything out of it except for bragging rights, because there's just very little amount of material that you'll be able to get, and you have no way of effectively targeting your target. With my luck, if I were doing it, I'd be getting some 15-year-old's bank account that has 15 cents in it.
Right. If someone was going to be doing this, so they're using the crack attack, as you mentioned, they don't get full decryption, but what usable information could they pull from, let's say, a poorly configured WPA2 network?
Well, it's not that the WPA2, and that's the other thing, it's not that WPA2 was broken. It had nothing to do with being a poorly configured network. And for the most part, you're going to see one-off. So you're not going to be able to see a network-wide amount of material. You're going to be looking at a particular individual user. And the other thing is, you've got to be right smack there. And even in the cases where you're doing a man in the middle, some people will say, well, I could be as many as 2 miles away with a high gain antenna. Right. And I know some really sharp shooters that could seriously make that shot too. But no, I think that in this case, it was, I think it was a nice slap in the face a little. Maybe there's been a little bit of complacency. My theory on why the world lost its mind over it is because I frequently use my mother as an example of, this is so easy, someone's mother could do it. Now, not my mother, but, someone's mother could do X, Y, or Z. Even my mother called that day that crack was announced and said, do I need to turn my Wi-Fi off? Is this something I need to be concerned about? And I think it's just the ubiquitous nature of Wi-Fi. We hear about something like WannaCry or NotPetya, and it makes the news. But for the most part, the average Joe or even the average, IT professional isn't that terribly concerned because it doesn't really affect them. Everybody uses Wi-Fi. My smoker uses Wi-Fi. My coffee maker uses Wi-Fi. So at that point, I think we got everyone's attention. And the answer to my mother was, if she could tell, if she was using Wi-Fi, I could tell her if she needed to turn it off.
Right. Oh,
because no, she doesn't.
Mo, actually, this does bring up an interesting corollary, and that's about responsible disclosure. Because we both know that the way that you make a splash at a DEF CON or a Black Hat is you come up with some wonderful crack, some wonderful exploit, and you kind of dramatize it a little bit. You try to get the eyeballs, you try to get the press, you try to get the people writing about it. But most of the time, it's an attack that regular people can't do anything about. It's the hacking of a rifle or the hacking of an advanced ATM machine. This was an announcement about a technology that pretty much everybody on the internet is using. Was this an irresponsible way to get those eyeballs? Because they did cause quite a bit of panic.
No, actually, absolutely quite the opposite. Because this, I was sitting in the audience at Black Hat in July when the initial paper was discussed. And the discoverer stood up there and said, frankly, this is of academic interest. There is nothing, there's no practical application to this. And he said that in July. And at the time, he had already disclosed to the two Wi-Fi vendors that he had used their access points in the initial attack that he had done earlier this spring, or the initial vulnerability that he had disclosed. So those vendors were notified before June, if I remember correctly. He then made a further disclosure at the end of August, and so all Wi-Fi vendors, the WFA, everybody was aware of this at the end of August, and so then the public announcement didn't happen until October.
Right.
I don't think, to be quite honest, and I'm just speaking for as a layman looking in with my 2020 glasses on, I don't think that most engineers, looking at the reality of what crack was and looking at the reality of what the mitigation steps were needed, realized what the optics were to the average person. I don't think anybody anticipated the world losing its mind, and I certainly didn't expect. And I think it was the Guardian or an English newspaper that declared that Wi-Fi had suffered the equivalent of an EMP.
Ouch.
And which is why the blog that I wrote was Keep Calm and Wi-Fi On. And it was simply because my marketing department wouldn't let me call it something else, which I won't tell
Stop
you.
Stop losing your minds. Yeah. So in other words, this was a responsible disclosure. It was irresponsible reporting.
Unfortunately, and I'm speaking to a journalist that I greatly respect, but I think that there was, I think that was a large part of it. I can tell you that I told you I'm an InfoSec junkie, so I follow a great many very smart people. So Sunday morning before the crack announcement, I started getting a niggling that in the Twitter feeds that this was going to happen. By Monday morning, the InfoSec world was intrigued, mildly interested, By Monday afternoon, they were sort of banging their heads against the wall saying, okay, can we just move on? And by Tuesday evening, they were literally screaming about, yeah, but what about this serious CVE that I've been waiting for a patch for the last 6 weeks? And so while everybody was still losing their mind about Wi-Fi, the InfoSec world was frankly pretty annoyed at the attention that it was drawing.
You know, it's interesting because here on TWiET, we covered it in a blip. So we mentioned that the research had been done, but then we didn't do anything more because, like you, the people that I'm following in InfoSec, they were all unified in saying, oh, this is interesting. It's an oddity. No practical purpose yet. It just kind of fell out of my consciousness until I saw the hashtag. People started freaking out that the Wi-Fi was broken and people were looking at all their private emails. I'm thinking, whoa, that's a huge disconnect.
Yes, and it really was. I think that's the best way to put it. It was a divorce from reality.
Now, why do you think that happens? I mean, is it just because so many people they depend on Wi-Fi and they don't really know how it works, and so any crack sounds like, oh, it's over. We need something new.
Well, and like I said, you know, we saw some pretty serious breaches and InfoSec issues going on last year with the NotPetya and the WannaCry, and I just think that that's a little esoteric and the average person really couldn't wrap their head around that. Again, take a look at all of your devices and tell me how many have an RJ45 connector on them anymore. Wi-Fi is ubiquitous, and I hate to keep banging on my mother about this, but she did call me and ask if she needed to turn her Wi-Fi off. And the answer is, you don't have Wi-Fi, Mom. You live in a Faraday cage. I have tried. No one can get Wi-Fi into that house from your satellite from 80 feet away. It's just a lack of understanding. But again, the idea that it's everywhere. I mean, every McDonald's across the U.S. has free Wi-Fi now. So I think it's just that, and it was just an easy thing for. And frankly, aside from clickbait, it was a good way to get people to turn on the news. I saw some remarkably irresponsible reporting, not just that one comment, but just across the way. Yes, I'm still bitter about it.
I'm sorry about that. And actually, that's part of my profession right now, so I am partly responsible. We should have come out more forcefully.
You handled it well.
We should have told people not to panic. We just reported on it. We just assumed people would be smart enough to realize, interesting, move on.
I think that your listeners are, and they were fine.
Exactly. The TWiET Riot, they're pretty good. Now, let's move on to WPA3, because this is something that people have heard about. And as you mentioned, WPA2, it's a little long in the tooth. It might be time to look at a different way of doing it. What are the prime features of WPA3 as you see them?
Right. And I'd like to preface this because I'm sure that most of the people, most of your audience has probably read the announcements around it and some of the blogs. And as I've said a couple of times at various places, a lot of them felt anemic. And the reason for that is that the Wi-Fi Alliance, the WFA, has confidentiality clauses. And so those who know can't say, and those who can't say, those who don't know are the ones talking more about it. So if you read some of the blogs and you think, well, I still don't understand anything about it, that's really the reason. So with the WPA3 features that they've announced, there's essentially four of them. Right now, two of them are going to be considered optional, and then two will be a requirement. So there's going to be the simultaneous authentication of equals, or SAE. And this is the idea behind this is to protect you from what was considered or it was typically considered to be passwords that aren't complex enough. And there's been a lot of really interesting publications recently about how complex do your passwords really need to be. And we've sort of gone down a road that we might not have needed to go down. But, you know, if you're using, something that's generally considered to be not complex, what this will do is actually sort of protect you against the brute force attacks that that leaves those passwords so vulnerable. Now, there's no fixing stupid. So this isn't going to be the panacea for all things. So I wouldn't go around, you know, making everything password 123. That's not what this is going to fix. And I used an example in an earlier conversation about one of the best, most prolific hackers in terms of stolen credit cards. And when he was, apparently everywhere he went, he used the same password on several different accounts. And these were observed by the law enforcement officials. So when they finally caught up to him on vacation with his encrypted laptop, they popped the thing open and tried that same password. And they got 127 million stolen credit cards sitting on that laptop. So that was pretty much all she wrote on that one for that guy. But the point with that is that, you know, if you're being stupid with your password, then, you know, this isn't going to help. But in terms of just trying to protect you against brute force attacks, this is going to be some good news for you. And then the other really nice feature of this, and this one's based on an RFC 8110, if anybody wants to go look that one up. It's opportunistic wireless encryption. And this is good news for everybody who likes to go to the hotel lobby or Starbucks and do banking, as I'm sure the Twilight Riot.
Some people still do that.
I'm sure there's Well, so there's been some comparison that this is going to give you the same kind of privacy across an open SSID as you get with a VPN. I'm not 100% there with it on that. But what it will do is instead of, it will look like it's an open SSID to my mom, for example. But there'll be a negotiation, and in fact, a handshake that goes on between the device and the access point to negotiate a shared key that's not human known. And so anything that's not human known is inherently more secure. And so that gives you that. And now it doesn't do solve the other problems. And frankly, this is the one thing that I thought might come, we'd see some good come out of the crack vulnerabilities, because it really highlighted the problem with man-in-the-middle attacks. And those, so if you're sitting at Starbucks, as long as you know that you're really talking to the Starbucks access point, then you're okay. But if you've suffered from a man-in-the-middle attack, then, you know, all bets are off. And so I'm still hoping that we find a way to better address some of those problems.
Right. Now, so I understand that the first feature is really it's a new handshake, right? It will help to prevent brute force dictionary attacks. How does that actually work? Can you shed any light on the technical design?
Not on the technical design. I can tell you that that it's going to be based on. No, actually, I can't tell you that part. Sorry, I tried to remember what. It's called threading the needle, and I didn't go to law school, so I am hoping that the protocol will be finalized towards the end of this month.
Oh wow!
And
okay.
We'll be able to. I hope I could say that. Well, I've done it, so a little bit later we should see some finalization going on, and we'll be able to talk a little bit more about it. I'm glad you brought up the dictionary attack, because I did see there was at least one blog out there that described a dictionary attack as being something involving Webster's dictionary. That's not, in this sense, that's not what a dictionary attack is.
Right.
If you're familiar with InfoSec and some of the hacking capabilities out there, one of the things that it's going to be useful for is these dictionaries that are more or less one-offs or created specifically, especially for like a spear phishing attack or a spear phishing type attack. Because one of the things that we're seeing more of is using web scraping and a use of open source material. So Padre, I went out to all of your social media accounts and anything that referenced you in the media in general. There are bots out there that can scrape and then turn all of that data into something usable in terms of I could create a Padre-specific dictionary and use that as an attempt to brute force against your your passwords. And that's really, I mean, that level of sophistication is what we're trying to mitigate with something like SAE.
That's a fascinating attack, actually. I didn't even consider looking for an individual's dictionary, because we don't tend to use all the words in the dictionary. We tend to kind of collapse it down to what it's in our vocabulary and what we use most often, and that's what ends
up something
passwords.
More specific to you. Yeah. And I think that we've seen a little bit more of that with and I dropped the term a whaling instead of spear phishing, but I know in especially in high-end resorts and spas and hotels, they've seen a rash of this. And not just last year, I mean, like for the last years, it's been going on where they're specifically targeting high-end people like CTOs, CFOs, CEOs, and making them the target of some, you know, the days of the Nigerian prince scam, okay, that's still out there, but we've gone way past that. These are not phishing emails with the misspellings and or anything like that. You're actually seeing things that where they're mimicking the language and even referencing something internal to the company. So there's some rather sophisticated research that's going on with these.
We are running out of time, so I want to bring my co-host back in. Chibert, I can see him in my preview monitor. He's kind of bouncing up and down because one of our other favorite topics here at Twite is the Internet of Own Things. And actually, WPA3 has a way to address that. Chibert, you want to take it away?
Yeah, I'm cribbing from Heather's notes here. She it's called the Device Provisioning Protocol, and it says it's a simple and secure way to add devices to a Wi-Fi network. Are we at a point where we can start talking about that? You know, right now I got to shove MAC addresses in for a lot of my IoT devices. Is there going to be a better way?
Right. Yeah, it's been really clunky. You're either doing something on a smartphone. So we're talking about IoT devices that are headless, that don't have a way to directly get in and provision them and make their connectivity secure. I can't think of a better way than just to say it's clunky. You're either hoping that there's Passpoint that's in effect someplace, or you're pretty much using some kind of clunky interface on your smartphone. And that's really what this one is aimed at. I think that in terms of not just IoT and whenever I think of IoT, I personally think of my house because I'm looking around it. And I'm not kidding. I have a smoker that I can work from my office and, you know, check the temperature of the brisket that's going to take another 17 hours to finish. It's lovely for that. But in terms of real world or the wider world, I think that for hospitality and MDU and integrators, this is going to be a really good thing. And I would love, you know what, I am going to go ahead and say something. It's not in any of the documentation I've seen, but I was at a conference with a WFA person who stood up and used the words. So she said it in public. I think that means that it's in the public sphere. It's going to use QR codes, and it may be the first time I've ever QR codes were a good thing.
Well, couldn't we just put a button on the back of the device so you push it and then it pairs like WPS? Because that was such a good idea.
Right. What device? What button are you going to put that to? Because I'm not going to go get a new refrigerator so that it can have
just
one of these buttons on it.
Our entire network knows that WPS is a bane, so that was just a little bit of fun. That very much interests me because that's become the new sore spot for networks, this idea of dropping especially headless devices onto my network and just hoping that the engineers did their job right. But always being disappointed. I want to bring in my other co-host here, Curtis. You were wondering about the. I know this is optional, Heather, but there was another feature set that we're looking at getting with WPA3 based on security. Curtis?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where we know that while little things like performance are critical for most decisions on deploying, You know, with WPA3, is this going to be the sort of thing that is good enough that it's going to disrupt refresh cycles when it comes to the wireless networks in companies, or do you think that most companies are going to stick with their current refresh cycles and just take advantage of it when, you know, the next, you know, 4, 5, 6 year period that they're working on rolls around?
Well, now, actually, that's sort of the good news. And I'll go back just for a second to the WPA2 enhancements, and I won't speak to every vendor, but I'm going to say pretty much every vendor is already there. So everything that is going to be included in the WPA2 enhancement certification, enterprise-grade Wi-Fi vendors are already there. For WPA3, these three features that we've talked about so far, I don't see that those will require a forklift upgrade, with the caveat being that we're talking about, you know, the newer access points, because there are going to be resources required. It's just not going to be at the chipset level. So, for instance, if you have 11AC Wave 2 APs, then I can't say definitively, but I would say that you're probably there, and I don't know that even Wave 1 wouldn't support most, if not all, of these features. The one that I can say, and that's the one feature that we didn't talk about, and it will be chipset reliant, and that's the 192-bit encryption. It's based on the Suite B protocols, and that will require some chipsets, and you hinted at it earlier with the quantum computing, Brian. That's really what we're headed at. The minute we have a viable quantum computer, the encryption that we have today will be worthless. It will be gone. And right. So, and since it takes years to develop new encryption algorithms and then to thoroughly test them and make sure that we don't have any serious vulnerabilities, that's why we're working, you know, the really smart mathematicians and people a lot smarter than me are working on that right now. And so I think it's very, you know, it's all very, very important, and I think this is a really good first step by the WFA.
Oh, Heather, we are out of time, but I did want to get a couple of final words from you about WPA3. I know, please don't say anything that's going to get you into trouble, so parse this out. But you did mention, maybe not an exact time frame, but this is coming sooner rather than later. This is not something that's 10 years out. WPA3 is in ongoing process.
No, and I think that's right. I mean, I think they're aiming at having the protocol finalized, and then at that point, the certification will become available, you know, a little bit further down the road with a hard cutoff, you know, a requirement that you be have it all in place, you know, maybe a year or two later. I would point to the adoption rate if you look at what we saw with 11N versus 11AC. And the adoption rate for new technologies has actually gotten faster and not slower. If you consider the fact that up until now, we still have to support, as a Wi-Fi vendor, we still have to have somewhere in the firmware support for WEP and TKIP, because God love us, we still have, right, you know, people out there using these little scanner guns and things like that. So it took a long time for WPA2 really to get ubiquitous, and it's still in some places, in some areas, not as well adopted. I think that you're going to see WPA3, and I'm a terrible futurist, but I think you're going to see the adoption rate, not just at the vendor level, but at the client level, much faster than you're anticipating.
Right. And I think the takeaway, to be responsible reporting here, the takeaway is we're looking at WPA3 just because WPA2 is long in the tooth. It's not broken. It's not a disaster waiting to happen.
What's next.
It's what's next. Exactly. So don't panic. Just look forward to what looks to be a really rich feature set for future encryption. Am I okay? Am I in the safe zone saying that?
You're absolutely in the safe zone.
Heather, Mo, from our interrupt days, I want to thank you so very much for being with us and for sharing your time, especially since it's such a difficult situation. Could you please tell people where they can find you, where they can find your work, where they can find Ruckus on the internet?
Well, we are ruckuswireless.com. I am Mo Better Wi-Fi on Twitter. And I actually will be headed to Singapore next week for Black Hat Asia, where there's going to be some fantastic InfoSec information being delivered. And I will be providing the Wi-Fi for that. So exciting day.
That's wonderful. And I will say this. I in our email exchanges, you did mention that there would be interest in perhaps visiting me at my next gig. We do have a wonderful meeting hall that's set up for 400 people and space for people to stay. So if you wanted to do an InfoSec conference in Rome, well, you know, we could probably set something up.
I'm pretty sure my bag is already packed
for that. Mo, it is always a pleasure, and I hope I get to see you soon. Thank you for spending your time with the Twilight Riot, and we bid you farewell.
Thank you.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 pre-shared keys. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, to our guest, Mo. It's always a pleasure to speak to her. And, yes, my co-host, without whom I would not want to do this show. Curtis, let's start with you. I know that you're in a temporary space. I know that it's kind of difficult for you just to set up a studio this quickly. But could you please tell the folks where they can find you over the next week or so?
Well, you can now find my writing pretty much every day at darkreading.com. I've got a piece coming up next week that I'm pretty excited about. It's the one that I mentioned where I was talking both to the CEO and CTO of SonicWall and to Secretary Michael Chertoff about some interesting stuff having to do with encryption and malware. Also have a piece on the latest generation in crypto mining malware that'll be coming out next week. So come on over to Dark Reading and find me there. Also look for me on Twitter at KG4GWA. And physically, I'm down in the Orlando area now, but I will be over at the Gaylord this next week at Enterprise Connect. So if you're interested in all things having to do with enterprise communications, stop by and see me.
Oh, that's interesting. Where am I going to be next? Oh, I'm also there. Curtis and I are both going to be at the Gaylord Palms for Enterprise Connect. If you're in the area, why not stop by, say hi, check out some interesting tech. Curtis, are you going to stop by my booth and just chill out with me? Or you're probably going to be working a little bit?
Oh, I will absolutely stop by. It wouldn't be a trip to Enterprise Connect without that.
Oh, fantastic. Curtis, again, a pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you in person in the next couple of days. Chibert, my friend, actually, I go back with you all the way to my very first interop. So we've been together for quite some time. Can you tell the folks what you're up to in your waterlogged state?
I'm just bummed that I can't be at Enterprise Connect with you guys, you know.
Soon, Chibert.
I'll tell you.
Soon.
Yeah, soon. Well, I'll tell you. I'm ADVNETLAB on Twitter, and I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. I've had some great suggestions from viewers, and we've got a whole nice lineup. I apologize. We really wanted to get some folks talking about LoRa. We will reschedule that because LoRa is going to make a very big splash in the world of IoT, and especially enterprise IoT, and I want to do a shout out to my buddies at Diagnostic Labs that are going to be using Cayenne to go do some temperature and water and so forth monitoring in their data centers because they don't have enough data.
Data centers without enough data. That sounds kind of weird. But Chibert, Curtis, always, always, always so much fun whenever I get to spend time with you. Gentlemen, thank you. And we'll see you on a future episode of Twilight. Of course, thanks to you. The person who's watching, who's listening, who comes back week after week for enterprise goodness. We wouldn't have a show for all these years without you. And we want to make it easier for you to get your Twilight fix. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twilight. That's This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you'll find all of our back episodes along with the show notes. If you click the links, you can find the links to the stories we talked about in our blips and our bites. You can find the contact information for our guest. It is the best place to catch up on what's happening during our episodes. Also, you may notice we've got a little drop-down menu for subscribing to the audio version, the video version, or the high-definition video version. That is the best way to support the show. Share that with your friends. Share that with your coworkers. Share that with people who you think would like to know a little bit more about this wonderful network that we call the Earth. Now, also, don't forget, you can find me on my Twitter page at twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll see what I'm doing when I'm not in the studio. And when I'm with Patrick Delahanty, he was really enjoying those pancakes. That was, that was fun. That was fun. Yeah. Anyways, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to all the engineers, to Burke, to Jammer B, to Alex, who makes sure everything around here continues to run, to Lisa and Leo, who let us continue to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and of course, to our fantastic TD. We call him the Shark. It's Kevin the Shark. Kevin, do you have a microphone on? Because this is the time where we normally test your knowledge to see if you're actually paying attention to the show that you were directing.
I have audio, just like Heather did. Audio only, though.
Okay, so let's make it really, really simple. How many different versions of there are there of WEP?
I've only heard of one, but there probably is two.
Oh, I'm sorry. The answer was none, because we've written it out of history. Kevin, thank you very much for trying.
This is unwinnable.
We'll give you another opportunity next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballister, the Digital Jesuit. Just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.